Hey guys, welcome back to 30 Minutes in the New Testament. This is episode number 11, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm Daniel Henry Price, and I am with Eric Sorensen. Eric, how's it going?
It's going well. We're staying busy out here in New York City. It's cold. Right now it's rainy. It might snow later in the week. And of course, my church plant has its next preview service this upcoming Sunday, so we're busy getting ready for that. But yeah, it's good. Exciting times.
So your Christmas is going well?
My Christmas is still going well, until the 6th of January,
yeah,
Daniel.
Yeah, still going well.
In which time we transition to the season of Epiphany.
Which is the name of your church?
The name of my church.
Boom. Ding. There it was.
That's
right
it.
On. Well, we are up in Matthew chapter 5 still. We will still be in Matthew chapter 5 at the end of this podcast as well, because there ain't no way we're going to get through the rest of this. But Jesus has made his way through the Beatitudes. He has talked about a little salt of the earth, a little light of the world. And now he's about to start talking about that law.
Yeah. So he says in verse 17 of chapter 5, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished." Now, Dan, I got some thoughts. I got lots of thoughts about these words, but what say you, my man?
Well, I think it's safe to say that at least one of the reasons, and I think there are several, but one of the reasons that Jesus is saying this is that already we've seen, and we've talked about in his ministry, he's sort of like when he first shows up on the scene, he shows up at the River Jordan, where John's baptizing all manner of different kind of sinner, and we know that Jesus comes and gets baptized with them as well, identifies himself with the sins of the world, identifies himself with the sinners of the world. We also know that the Pharisees see this. We know that the scribes and the Pharisees and religious leaders were present, observing John's baptism, not to go partake of it. Not they weren't going to participate because they were way too holy for that nonsense. But they definitely saw it. And then after that, you know, it says people are coming out to Jesus and he's healing people and taking care of people, and so he's amassing sort of this following of low people. And when you are showing a lot of compassion and mercy and grace to sinners, and when you're identifying yourself with sinners, when you're amongst mm-hmm. sinners, mm-hmm. an accusation that you will receive is that you just don't care about the law. You just mm-hmm. don't care about the law of God. And I think that Jesus does some of that right here. I mean, if you do this in your own life, the time will come where you're gonna have to like say to somebody, "Look, man, I'm not abolishing the law. I'm not saying that the law is no good. I'm not saying that. Never said that." Jesus does the same thing here, and says he says something that we can't say though. So we just leave it right there and say, "Look, I'm not trying to abolish the law. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm doing." Jesus gets to take it a step farther and say something that we can never say, and he says, "I haven't come to abolish the law; I've come to fulfill it."
Yeah. I think you're spot on that one of the reasons he says this at this very central sort of proclamation of his kingdom in the Sermon on the Mount is to assure people, no, just because I am identifying with sinners and I am healing them and I am loving them, don't get the impression that that in any way means that I lessen the law. Not one bit, or the way he puts it, not an iota, not a dot. There's no one who appreciates the law more than me, Jesus says, so much so that I've come to fulfill every single part of it. I think also in here, one of the things that this statement does coming from Jesus is It banishes or puts away a caricature that sometimes is made about Jesus, which is that Jesus is sort of seen as the warm and fuzzy version of God who ignores the rules and doesn't seem to really care all that much about it. It's just all about mercy. It's all about grace. And he doesn't care about the law. You might not hear it stated that bluntly or that blatantly, but that has been a teaching in the in parts of the church that we would say were errant. And Jesus says, no, 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 I value the law. I value it so much. I'm going to do everything necessary to fulfill it. And so it sort of it puts that notion aside. Jesus is not any different than the God of the Old Testament. Jesus is the same exact God. He is just here in the flesh to fulfill it on our behalf.
Yeah, yeah. There's this. You can kind of get trapped in this idea that that God the Father and God the Son, so Jesus and then the God the Father are sort of playing good cop bad cop with you. And one of them is trying to beat you down. The Father's just angry all the time. He's that Old Testament God. And right. Jesus is that New Testament God, and he's sort of just like a hippie.
Right, right. Yeah. That's the way it's presented a lot of the – I've heard that kind of view of things, and in the passage like this just shuts that down.
Right.
But there's an ultimate – I mean, I think there's a more important question that really comes up here too, and that is, why was it necessary for Jesus to fulfill the law in the first place? Why is that so central to his ministry?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot implied when he says, hey, I haven't come to abolish it but to fulfill it. I think that tells you straight up that you can put aside and do away with any notions that you're going to do some fulfilling of the law. That's what Jesus. I mean, listen to this statement. Like, there's a couple of sort of purpose statements that Jesus has given, even thus far, that have been given for Jesus. You have, you have the declaration of his birth, where he will save his people from their sins. You have, you have things like John the Baptist saying, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world," mm-hmm. and you've got Jesus saying, like, he doesn't say, like, "I'm not against the law. I'm going to obey the law." That's not what he says.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what he says. He doesn't say, like, "I'm not here to tell people the law is no big deal. Like, watch, I'll obey it." No. Mm-hmm. He says, "Do not think that I have come." Mm-hmm. So the purpose in my coming is to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill them. In other words, that the fulfillment of the law is part of the motivation for his being here in the first place. This is part of his objective. This is part of the mission to fulfill the law, which would imply, and there's other passages, obviously, in the New Testament, and where Paul would get very emphatic on this point, that is absolutely necessary because he and he alone can.
Yeah, right. The purpose or the point of so much of the rest of the New Testament is to say, as Paul does in Romans, there is no one good, no, not one. That none of us have even come close to fulfilling the law. And Jesus will really underscore that throughout the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, because he's going to move into different commandments throughout the Old Testament law. And essentially what he's going to do is he's going to show how if we really fulfilled these laws, if we were really doing it, it doesn't just mean outwardly, it means inwardly, from the heart, perfectly, from conception. And so essentially what's going to happen is Jesus, throughout the rest of the sermon, is going to kill any illusions on our part that we can save ourselves.
Yeah.
He's essentially announcing by saying he's here to fulfill the law, "I'm here to fulfill the law for you, for the forgiveness of your sins. You need someone to do this on your behalf, and I'm the one who's going to do it."
That's right. I mean, this ties into what he says next, because he says, "Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches others will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, that's okay. Like, that's a huge statement there. And, like, because, like, the end of that is such a punch in the face to the scribes and Pharisees, like, we kind of want to we want to camp there and we'll get there. But it can kind of overshadow another thing of what he just said, which is sort of an interpretive key for everything that's about to come next. Because what he says is, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same. What he's about to tell you about anger and lust,
exactly,
and hatred, like he's about to tell you, he's going to explain what relaxation of the law looks like.
Listen, there's so much here, but let me just say right now, the ones who relax the law in the New Testament, and I would argue still today, are more often than not the most legalistic people you know.
Yes.
Now, that sounds counterintuitive because legalism implies that they really, really care about the law. But if they really cared about the law, being presented as it is, especially in this Sermon on the Mount, then they would have to acknowledge that there is no possible way that any of us could come close to fulfilling what Jesus lays out here in the Sermon on the Mount. There's, in other words, what he's saying, and it's interesting, we know that the Pharisees did actually refer to the law. They broke up the law and they divvied some of the laws to be, quote, lighter commands, and other commands to be weightier.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could sort of find a way to justify yourself by saying, well, you know, yeah, technically I'm not perfect, but this part is not as important as that part. And the Pharisees did this all the time.
And you know what's awesome about that is Jesus flips that script on them too and says, you've neglected the weightier matters of the law, which is mercy.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's
right. In his woes later on, he's going to call him out on that. So even the laws that they think they have upheld, Jesus shows they haven't.
Right. And in the weightier, lighter matters, if this is such a thing, they've got it backwards. So like the Sabbath is like this super weighty, but Jesus seems to think that love your neighbor is super weighty. Like that's like be, and by loving your neighbor, not like beating him up over what he has or hasn't done, but being merciful to him, loving him well.
That's right.
This whole thing gets flipped around, but you have to read everything that Jesus is about to say. And I'll do you guys a favor and make sure that I bring this up with each one of these points. I'll just beat this into your head. You're welcome. When he talks about anger, when he talks about lust, when he talks about divorce, when he talks about oaths, reconciliation, loving your enemies, all of this stuff, he's going to like say some stuff about you've heard it said, but I say to you, he is talking about you've heard it said, and that's a relaxation of the law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, and this is important, sometimes the way it's read is that Jesus is quoting, when he says you've heard it said, the Old Testament.
No, he's quoting the
Old Covenant laws. He's not. He's quoting the common view of the religious establishment at the time and contradicting them. And so it's no wonder that he does not make friends with the religious establishment nearly from the beginning, because he calls them out on basically all of the ethical teachings that they had and says, guess what? You haven't been doing it good enough. As a matter of fact, you're not even close. You're not even close.
Not even close. Yeah. I mean, when he moves on from that, then so this part that kind of overshadows that relaxation part, which is, like I said, the sort of interpretive key you need for the rest of this. But then when he says that unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Man, dude, these are professional religious people.
Right. Like, I mean, there's no one that looked and sounded more religious and more godly, quote unquote, than this crowd.
It's their literal job to be righteous.
Right.
Like they're the vocation of being righteous and mm-hmm. teaching other people to be righteous. And if you were asking just the everyday Jews, like, hey, who are like the most righteous people? They'd say, well, I mean, the scribes, man, and the Pharisees. I mean, they're the ones teaching us, and they're writing out the you know, the law of Moses, and they've devoted their lives.
Think about what the scribe's job was. It was literally reading and copying scripture.
Pretty righteous, man. Pretty righteous.
Yeah. It doesn't get more righteous looking than that.
That's right. And so if you ask just the regular people, they'd be like, those guys are pretty righteous, man. I mean, I got to work like a regular job, and I got to take care of my family. These dudes are doing righteousness day in and day out as a job, man. It's like their whole gig is that. And Jesus says, like, yeah, your righteousness has got to exceed that, which has got to be just this crushing statement, because you're like, well, dude, if they're not righteous enough, who's righteous enough? And the answer to that question is no one. That's why I'm here, to fulfill that law. Circle back around. That's right.
And, you know, I mean, there's like three ways that I hear verse 20 in our passage interpreted. Where he says, for I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. One way that I've heard is that we really must be super righteous in and of ourselves. And this is used in a way oftentimes to, I think, really bludgeon Christians to, you know, and then a call to examine themselves to see if they're really in the faith. And of course, if you can find ways in which you're not really, really righteous, then you can kind of go, I guess I'm not in the kingdom. But I don't think that that's what Jesus is saying here. There's a second way that I think gets closer, where Jesus says, essentially is saying our deeds are more righteous, or his followers are more righteous because their actions, their deeds, their thinking is coming from a new heart. So he's alluding to this idea that the righteousness that comes from his people it's not that it might look more righteous on the outside than a scribe or Pharisee. It might look exactly the same, but it springs out of a new heart. And that is what makes a work righteous. But even still, I still don't think that that really gets to the heart of the matter. I think what's really being implied here is the imputation of Christ's righteousness.
Absolutely. You don't need like really darn good righteousness.
No. You need perfect righteousness.
Perfect righteousness, man. I mean, otherwise you end up taking this, and people do this, and they'll say, well, a self-righteous person, a Pharisee, would just think that they'd kept the law by not committing adultery. Now, certainly there's tons of people that think that. Now, and certainly they thought that. I mean, Jesus is going to straight up say that. But then they'll take Jesus' words and they'll be like, but a really righteous person doesn't even lust. And then if you like actually then audit yourself and then be like, all right, sweet. Mm-hmm. All right, so I could check. All right, so like I'm not.
You haven't really audited yourself.
No, everyone's coming up guilty on that, man. Like Jesus is about to condemn like the entirety of the human population in the next couple verses.
Yeah. Now, and by the way, I mean, so the way that this can be heard is that then we're saying that Jesus doesn't want his followers to
fight lust,
to attempt to avoid these things. No, of course, these are things that are good for us. It is better for us not to lust. It is better for us not to give in to unjust anger. It is good for us to want those things. But we ought not fool ourselves that we've attained this. This is something that we get purely from Christ alone to stand perfectly righteous before the throne room of the Father.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. We can confess that you got to be able to hold some things in both hands. And you got to be able to say the law, as Jesus is about to exegete it, is right and holy and good. And is what we
ought. As Paul does in Romans 7.
Yes. And is what we ought to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All that stuff is affirmed. It's what we ought to do. It's good, righteous, and holy.
Yes. It is one of the two words of God. That's right. It's the first word. It's just not the final word, which is the word you need when you figure out that, hey, I can say that that's good and right and I ought to do it all day long and, man, give it my darndest. I mean, just, like, go for it. But when I inevitably come up short, and when you inevitably come up short, and you do inevitably come up short, man, you need another word, and that word is I've fulfilled all that law on your behalf, right, in your stead. Like that, and you got to be able to have both these things. You can't let the law usurp the gospel and become the way to salvation or the way to righteousness. The law, Paul is super clear on this. Like the law was never given as a means to become righteous. You were never going to become righteous through the law. It was never going to happen.
And Jesus really intensifies that in this sermon. You know, there's one thing that I keep thinking about as we're going through this, and that is that our preaching needs to reflect this use of the law. So often I hear preaching of the law that makes it seem like it's something attainable, something that we can do in and of our own strength. I hear it so often from Christian pulpits. And that's precisely opposite of what Jesus and the apostles do. They lay out a case that makes the law so awesomely high. They take it so awesomely serious that it's meant to drive us to Christ, as Paul will say to the Galatians and to the Romans. Its purpose is to shut our mouths from justifying ourselves.
Yeah, Paul calls it the ministry of death. Yeah. Now ministry is a good thing. Like the law comes to administer death to him.
Right.
I mean, this is the thing. Even when it's telling me that, like, this is God's standard. This is what God is like. This is holy, right, and good. And I can take all those things. Like, this is what it means to be like God. And I can look at all those things, and I can acknowledge all those things, and amen all those things, and say yes, yes, yes. And the whole time I'm doing it, I'm being accused. As the Lutheran confessions say, that the law always accuses. Even while I'm acknowledging that it's a good thing, it's still a ministry of death to me. It's still killing me, and it's still accusing me, no matter what.
That's right. It never stops accusing, even when it's coaching us.
No, never. No, it's an accusatory word to us always, because we're not good. I mean, and that's the thing. When you say something like the law always accuses, people think that you're somehow saying something bad about the law. No, I'm saying something bad about me. I'm saying that the law is good and that I'm not, therefore it accuses me of my badness. Like, so saying the law always accuses isn't saying something degrading about the law. It's calling me what I am, which is not good like the law is.
Yeah, but that's all for the purpose of bringing us good news. I mean, that the whole point in it is it's only by acknowledging our need that we begin to see Christ is all sufficient. The law hammers us to the point of submission. And that's the whole point. That's the main use of it. So that we would see Christ as more than enough and our only hope, so that we would come to him pleading for mercy and being confident that we have it.
That's it. That's it. Man, you think we can plow through this? We got 6 or 7 minutes. Plow through the first one here, anger. Let's see what a little relaxation of the law looks like.
I think so, yeah. So Jesus says, verse 21, you have heard that it was said to those of old. Remember, he's not quoting the Old Testament. He's quoting the usage at the time. You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire.
That is an amping up right there, man.
Yeah, that is. I mean, so you talk about, this is Jesus' example. This is how the law is preached. You deserve hell for calling your brother a fool. I mean, it seems like, well, what are you talking about? I didn't do anything to him. I didn't hurt him. I just thought he was a fool. I just said he was a fool. Like, and you know, I didn't mean it. It wasn't really me. I was just grumpy and I hadn't eaten yet in the morning. You know, but I didn't mean it. And Jesus says, doesn't matter.
Yeah,
you're guilty.
That, yeah, it says it's murder. I mean, the first there's like a twofold thing going on here, right? One is to you know, to show you what the law, what the heart of the law really is, right? This is about your neighbor and the way, like, murder is about the way you treat your neighbor, and murder flows out of anger, and so the root problem of murder is anger. And that if that's the root problem, that anger displays itself in a number of different ways that maybe don't all end up in murder, but they all end up with the root sin, which is you being angry with your brother, which is all murder to God, right? And the other thing,
so it's like, yeah, it's the seed that eventually grows into the tree that becomes murder.
Exactly. And what he also does is he busts up everyone's self-righteousness. There's a reason that he goes murder and adultery here, right? Mm-hmm. Like, these are the two he decides to start jump off on. Because if you look through the Ten Commandments, you might think that you can check some of those off. I mean, especially if you're a little deluded. But
right.
You're probably going to be like, net, like, do not steal. Like, okay, everyone's like stolen something, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, oh man, I whatever, you know, that little extra time
I took on, a pen from work,
yeah, a little extra time on lunch, whatever.
Yeah,
like, don't covet. Come on,
we live in America, it's not possible,
right? I mean, yeah. Like, everyone's doing that, you know. So, all of these kind of things, right? Don't lie, everyone's white lied it before, right? So, these are sort of the ones that, like, but you also don't feel too bad about them because you're like, everybody does it. Like, everybody's done that. Like, dude, yeah. Everyone's coveted. Everyone's lied. Yeah. Everyone's done this stuff. Mm-hmm. So he goes straight to the ones that so many people think they're nailing. And he's all
sure.
Like, and he's like, murder and adultery. Cause you know, like, people are like, tell you the two things I know for sure I haven't done. I haven't killed anyone. And I haven't betrayed my marriage vows. Haven't done those. So boxes checked, at least those two.
Yes.
And so he goes right after those two big ones that everyone thinks they're doing. He's like, oh, heard it said don't commit murder. Oh, heard it said don't commit adultery. I got some stuff for you right here. You're all a bunch of adulterous murderers.
Yeah.
that's what he does.
Yeah, the picture presented of humanity is pretty bleak. I mean, there's no mincing words. There's no, there's nothing very seeker-friendly sounding about this sermon at this point. I mean, he's just crushing people all over the place. But again, for the ultimate purpose that they'd be brought to see him as their sufficiency, because he alone is the fulfillment of the law. He's the fulfillment of all righteousness.
Yeah, yeah. Let me see if I can rock out the rest of this. This is a little bit weird. He kind of gives a little illustration here. It says, so if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before you go to the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going to him, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. That's a little bit of a strange illustration. Let me tell you this. There's a real sense in which Jesus is saying, if you're angry with your brother, if you hate him, I don't want your money.
Right. I mean, and I don't want your worship.
Yeah.
I mean, so because he says going to the altar.
Yeah.
But if you're not, this is some tough, these are some tough words. It, the way this manifests itself, this murderous attitude, is essentially Jesus is saying, by you refusing to reconcile with your brother. That's a tough, so there is a tough word here for us, because Jesus is saying, this is what you ought to be doing, or else what's going on in your heart is something that leads to murder.
Yeah.
It's a manifestation of that murder, because you refuse to be in reconciliation with them.
Right. And you know, I mean, there's numerous times, you know, where, I mean, you take even the Lord's Prayer, for example, like, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jesus does say, if you do not forgive one another, neither will my Father in heaven forgive you. I mean, he straight up says that. That's not easy to deal with. That's uncomfortable. But I think what the real implication here is that, you know, there's the same kind of thing where he also says, he who is forgiven much loves much. And that, mm-hmm. And the whole point of this just beating you with the law is that you need to come into a knowledge of how much forgiveness you have required,
mm-hmm.
which will then make it nearly impossible for you to withhold forgiveness.
Right. That's the scoop. That's the goal right there. That we come to see ourselves as much worse than we thought. I mean, and we want to, I mean, I want to say, to be sensitive to people that have been really hurt, that I recognize that this can be a timely process. This kind of thing is not easy.
Well, there's such a thing as righteous indignation and that sort of thing. And you could be upset with someone who's wronged somebody or something. But there's a fine line. This is the danger. The thing you must be careful of is when you cross that line into the murder of the heart, which is never okay. This is where we have forgotten what we have been forgiven.
Right, right. And that's, I mean, that, so it's by marinating in how much grace we've received and we continue to receive on a daily basis that makes us people that become willing to reconcile with those people that have hurt us.
That's it.
And that's sort of how the manifestation of not being filled with anger, that's what it looks like.
That's it. So basically, the relaxation of that law, do not murder, looks like this. Hey, I haven't killed anybody. I just cut him up behind his back.
Right.
Or I just thought horrific thoughts about him and doesn't even bother me.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And we're out of time. Yeah. We're beyond out of time. That was it, man. This is going to be like, you're going to get a couple little minutes extra. What can we do? Jesus is beating us with the law. We got to take it. And we didn't want to cut you short. Guys, thank you so much for hanging out, joining us. Hey, if you like the podcast, if you like what we're doing over at Christ Old Fast, go over to ChristOldFast.org and you can hit us up over there. There's a support page. You can make a donation of any kind, reoccurring, one time. Thank you so much to those of you who have done that. It really does help us out a lot. And we will see you guys next week.